It's 1 o'clock, so it's time to get started with sermons, which are not Narishkeit. Sermons are a very important part of American Judaism. It's one of the differences maybe between American Judaism and Israeli Judaism, but we'll leave that for another time. A pleasure to welcome back Zev Elef, Dr. Zev Elef, who will give us a talk how rabbis, I think, use sermons from Egypt and anti-Semitism and came here. So, Vakasha, Rav Zev, it's all yours.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman, and thank you all for showing up again. So our business today, very different than peanut oil from last week, is to take a close look at rabbinic sermons. This type of research often puts scholars to sleep. But what I'm interested here is archetypes, particular, call them items, call them determinants of rabbinic markings. What I mean by that is, in some ways, Jewish history is a relatively new thing. We differentiate and we create new types of Jewish history. We are critical and we assess various epics or various people on their own. That's really a 19th century idea. Before then, and likely most of you have heard some of this before from others, is what Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi referred to as Jewish memory. He wrote a very important series of essays in a book called Zachor in the late 1970s. Memory is vitally important. How did Jews mark time? Usually through their calendar or their lineage in a Sidur or a Machzor or a Chumash that was passed on from generation to generation. But standalone history, understanding, let's say, 1648, Tach V'Tach, the Kamenetsky massacres on its own, wasn't something that happened in its moment. To the contrary, tragedies were folded in to the Tisha B'Av moment, and victories became a modern-day Purim, or salvations became a modern-day Pesach. Well, the same thing is true for how Jews understood their heroes and their villains. A particular type of hero was an Esther Hamalka. A particular type of warrior, which was few and far between, usually we celebrated the rabbinic sagacious leader, was a Yehuda HaMakabi. There was a particular type of hero who became a Moses figure, a Moshe Rabbeinu, or Yehoshua ben Nun. An Avraham was a Baal Chesed, somebody who represented loving kindness, and our heroes were framed through archetypes that existed in Tanakh. I think anything I've said is quite controversial. What I want to look at with you for a little bit this afternoon is, what about the villains? Which type of evil becomes a villain? Which becomes a pyro? Which type of villain becomes a pyro? Which type of villain is akin to an egel hazahav, a golden calf? Who deserves the appellation, the designation of a mullik? There are certain types of behavior, certain types of trends, which fit into different archetypes. So our business this afternoon is to go from Paro, from the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and his many evil descendants, to understand how have sermons or rabbinic writing writ large, my hypothesis is that we have sorted our evil in distinct categories. Therefore, what I'm suggesting and what we'll investigate this afternoon is a type of heinous destructive force becomes a pharaoh, another becomes a golden calf, another becomes a molech, this strange death cult. And can we see in the rabbinic writings that intuitively, generations of rabbinic writers have identified certain categories to sort evildoers throughout Jewish history. So let's look first at And please interrupt, raise a hand if you need. By all means, I encourage being interactive, if you'd like to put in the chat. Also wonderful. Well, the Midrash, in most of the instances, gives us a template from which to work. Ve'yakam Melech Chadash, from the beginning of Exodus, Shemot, Aleph, Chet, Rav v'Shmuel. This is a debate between Rav and Shmuel. We don't have preserved who said which. Chad Amar Chadash Mamash. One suggests that, yeah, a new pharaoh, a new king came, emerged over Egypt. One says, you know what, a totally new king. V'chad Amar Shidchadshu Gezerot. No, no, no. It was somebody, it was the same pharaoh who knew Yosef HaTzadik, who knew Joseph and his brothers, and Jacob and Yaakov, but he forgot Yosef. He forgot his dealings with the Shvatim, with the brothers, and so he renewed his hatred, his will be anachronistic, his anti-Semitic policies. Mon d'amar chadash mamash tiv chadash, because it says v'chamel chadash. Read the words. I'll be pshat. It was a new pharaoh. Mon d'amar shi chadshu b'zerotav t'lo k'tiv v'yamad v'imlo. Why? Because it doesn't tell us the previous monarch died. Asher lo yada et Yosef. Did not know Yosef, Dahave, Demi, and says that he does not know Joseph. That's the end of the verse in beginning of Exodus. Dahave, Demi, come on, Delo, Yadale, Klal. So what are they bothered by? How could it be that a pharaoh who was so good at the end of Genesis, who requested an audience with Yaakov, could immediately flip in the other direction? And so, two possibilities. Either it was a new pharaoh altogether, or it means, no, this is a reminder that monarchies can easily forget how good the Jewish people were to their empires. And that's exactly what you see in rabbinic work. Quite, and all of these, unfortunately, are terribly ominous. Rabbi Joseph Hertz, from the Hertz Chumash, and also the chief rabbi of England, in Passover sermon in 1933, suddenly a new dynasty comes into power and breaks completely with the ways of its predecessors. A nationalist pharaoh, 1933. Nationalist pharaoh ascends the throne and announces his resolve to rid Egypt of all aliens and all alien influence, and certain literary license, of course. I shall not labor the Egyptian analogy, but what need be neither rabbi nor even religionist to see that the world is built somehow on moral foundations, that no nation which chooses anti-Semitism, namely the will to hate, as the basis of its national life, can have a future. It is the fervent prayer of all good men and true that, both for the sake of Jewry and of Germany, the eyes of its blind rules, should be rulers, I assume, be opened. Racial hysteria and oppression vanish like so much smoke from that land, and righteousness and peace and freedom again become mighty arms. What had happened in the early 1930s is, of course, the rise of the Nazis as the majority government in Germany, Yimach Shemam Vizichram. And so to understand the moment of how Hitler, Yimach Shemam, and his anti-Jewish policies, first on Shlita, on ritual slaughter, and then many others. I'm sure Professor Shapiro spoke about that at some point in the Torah in Motion literature, or the Torah Shemal Pev of Torah in Motion. In any case, to understand the moment, how Germany, which at one time had representation, significant representation of Jews in parliament, had embraced contribution of Jews in science and in the arts, again, with certain limitations. how to understand it? The only way is to understand the context of the Akam Melech Chadash. At this point in the Jewish interaction, in the rabbinic interaction, with the Nazis, they are Vayakam Melech Chadash. They are a new king who arose upon Egypt. Who else is Vayakam Melech, is a pharaoh? So there's a rabbi, Yaakov Yisrael Berger. Don't know too much about him, but he's a rabbi. in the 1930s and 1940s in Cleveland, Ohio. Harben Yisrael, writing in 1948, Asher Poslim, Echtei Hasifim, many Jews standing upon these two dividers, a rabbinic term that is you see quite throughout through sermonic writings. Chashvu, ki omnam kvar higia hashal asof nidcha Yisrael, both nidutse Yehuda me'er bakvod haaretz. Jews had interpreted that it's time to bring the dispersed of the exiles back to a central place, being Eretz Yisrael. So they enlisted as many people as they could to help the cause in 1940, in the post-Holocaust era, to bring the Jews to Israel. And they put their stock in certain imperial powers in their hands. Pashta et harega l'kov tuchot shal mushlim asher liteyam v'yikam malach adash shen chadshu b'zeratav v'zerot v'yikvot al yeshuv asher kvar nimtza b'adnat kodesh. And a new king arose whose decrees were renewed with decrees and persecutions against the community already in the Holy Land. What are they referring to? They're referring to certain promises in negotiating with Britain to ensure that after they had a certain agreements in good faith that the British mandated overturned. And it's only in that moment, and this is later on in the sermon, with the vote in the United Nations and the agreement and the pressure applied to England to offer Jews sovereign Israel, Britain is cast as Ve'yikam Melech Hadash Shel Yada Et Yosef. And years ago, Dr. Arnold Lustiger, who has written much on Rabbi Soloveitchik and transcribed a number of his addresses, he has a wonderful kamut, which I think is written, summarized in brief in the line-by-line commentary. Here it is in the fuller version. Here, if you, it's a little bit small, but if you want to read in the windows here, it's on the left image on the bottom left going on to the right, but I'll read it and I transcribed it for you. In a sense, Pharaoh indeed did not know. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik delivering a Parsha Shir in Boston in 1980. Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered his Parsha Shirim on Motzei Shabbat on Saturday night. We're led to believe he did so because he wanted to make sure that rabbis didn't rely on him for their Chomer Ledrush, for their material. So he didn't want to do it before Shabbos. He did it after Shabbos. So if they were going to leverage his material, they would have to wait a full year to do so. In a sense, Pharaoh indeed did not know what Joseph did for Egypt. Earlier, we read that Joseph settled his father and his brothers, as Pharaoh has maintained. Pharaoh instructed that the family be fed. This is straight out of the end of Sefer Bereishit. No matter how long the family remained. Now a new king appears who did not honor the agreement, who did not appreciate what Joseph did. Chazal say that as long as Jacob was in Egypt, the Nile River used to rise to water the land. And with his death, it stopped rising. Later upon Joseph's death, there was no one qualified to guide the destiny of the Egyptian nation. The decline of Egypt was signaled by Pharaoh's desire to let us deal shrewdly with that right after the Kamal Chadash, which further precipitated Egypt's decline. So there was something to the economics of it all. A similar decline took place in Germany. Of course, that would be with the treaty to end World War I, in the wake of German persecution of the Jews. And so he drew this parallel again. And Rabbi Soloveitchik also has a similar refrain in referring to communist Russia and the czars. It's the Ve'yikam Melech Hadash Shelo Yada Et Yosef. So who is Ve'yikam Melech Hadash? Before we get into these other archetypes of evil, it's a betrayer. Who does rabbinic mind identify as a Ve'yikam Melech Hadash? Somebody who ought to have known better. A monarch, a government, in the case of the British mandate, who had all of the resources to assess situation and continue an alliance with the Jewish people and decided for whatever reason not to. You can find evidence, we only have so much time, that every single president of the United States, so it's bipartisan, from Jimmy Carter onward, I have collected enough sources that somebody at some point has called that president. I'm not suggesting at all that a president, be clear, is a pharaoh figure, but the impulse to describe or to find a biblical archetype, a biblical sorting mechanism to understand contemporary evil is really powerful. And who becomes a pharaoh? Somebody who has deceived the Jewish people. Somebody who ought to have known better. This contrasts with a Moloch. A Moloch is an untapped sort of evil, of villainy. Mashal amad davar doma, does the Medrash tell us, lambati. This is well known. What is a Moloch comparable to? To a hot bath. Lambati rotechat shlo haya bari yochol liyare b'tocha. It's a scalding bath that no living organism can possibly jump into. Bav and Balial, this no goodnik. Echad, kafetz biyare l'tocha. Somebody sacrifices themselves with no sense of, forget about salubrity. So no sense of for their own welfare, and they jump. That's what a Moloch. A Moloch attacked the Jewish people. Read the Sidra not too long ago, a couple weeks ago, and jumped there. They sacrifice themselves, but they cool down the water so somebody else could take advantage. Afalpi Shnechova, even though that a Moloch, this evildoer was hurt in the meantime, but Ikira, it cooled it off, the bathwater, the defenses, so to speak, so it's a type of evil that has no regard, no purpose. It is just this malfeasant. It is a type of evil that you cannot possibly penetrate the logic. It is not doing it for gaining power. It does not commit atrocity for the sake of an ideology. It is just through and through evil. It is not to use a comic book framing, it is not Lex Luthor. It is not somebody who looks for power or world domination. It is the Joker. It is somebody who just wants to do evil to Gotham City. Rav Chanan Wasserman. So Rav Chanan Wasserman in Kobetz Ma'ararim. Who does he say is this? This is interesting. In this case, he's actually looking at some Jews. We know that we have to battle with a Moloch in each and every generation. We know that this is the good against evil, but this, again, pernicious sort of illogical, unrestrained evil. Torah, Jewish people had Torah at least. And it fought an outsider of the seed of Amalek. Avam, Sheparkenu Olatar Mimenu, but because Rav Chanan Wasserman writing in the early 20th century, because the Jewish people, again, I'm just reporting the news or the views of somebody else, because the Jewish people have forsaken the yoke of Torah, Shratzu Zera Amalek Bitochenu. You can identify parts of Amalek within our own camp. And so there are evildoers in our own midst who could be called Amalek. Kimo, Yevexas. So these were the sort of a Jewish wing of the Communist Party. Not just in the Red State, meaning in the Soviet Union, in that area. Kiim bechot tfotzot Yisrael. And they exist in every area, wherever there are Jews. And so Jewish communists become an Amalek. They're illogical. According to Rav Chanan Wasserman, communism makes no sense. Again, his view, just reporting the news. And because it's so illogical, because he can't make sense of it, he brands it a form of Amalek. Rabbi Soloveitchik, and this is an important source. You see that Rabbi Lamb has an essay about it, quoting Rabbi Soloveitchik's father. But here is the earliest source that I know of the Soloveitchik family's tradition over what is Amalek. Amalek who, Tim Zera Obo, so what is it? Amalek is the essence of evil and justice, of human evil. This is, I think, my translation. My father would say in the name of his father that he who optimizes Amalek is the type of wickedness that affirms, as Siloam says, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. More than this, there is no substantive difference between all the various articulations of this sort of evil and hatred of the Jewish people. So somebody just says unabashed hate becomes their Amalek. It's not, and that's why is Soloveitchik family so beholden to it? Because the Rambam writes in Hilchot Melachim that the nations of Canaan were all wiped out. And therefore, there's no worry about who they are because they're all wiped out or confused or assimilated, but doesn't mention Amalek in this grouping because offers all the rabbis Soloveitchik. This I'm thinking about Reb Chaim or Moshe Soloveitchik and the Rav, and many of their intellectual successors. Therefore, they learn because the Rambam leaves out Amalek that they were not assimilated. That Amalek transcends biology, transcends DNA, and you can an evildoer can adopt a position of Amalek. And what is that? Unreserved, unabashed, undaunted sort of evil. And this became part of polemics in Jewish life, in Israeli life, of arguing, for example, in war reparations. Here you have Menachem Begin, and this is from a transcript of Knesset in 1951. Honorable Knesset members, on March 13th, 1951, the foreign minister, eventually Prime Minister Moshe Sharet, read out to us the note which he had sent to America, England, France, and Russia regarding what he called reparations from Germany. During the debate, it's a very live issue, should Israel accept reparations from Germany? What was Begin's consideration? During the debate, I attempted to share with the members of Knesset the tremendous shock which I felt. My third appeal is to the members of the religious parties. You contested the election in the name of the religion of Israel, the Torah of Israel. What connection is there between, and he would lose this debate, did Menachem Begin, what connection is there between the Torah of Israel and negotiations with Amalek? For by this vote, you will wipe off an entire verse, which has been sanctified by the Torah. The Lord will be at war with Amalek throughout the ages. Exactly what Rabbi Soloveitchik was quoting a slide ago. How can the Lord fight Amalek if you, the defenders of the religion, vote for peace with Amalek, for receiving money from Amalek? Now, sometimes evil has different incarnations. And to make sure that we stay on target in learning about Pesach, this is an interesting source, which we only have in the English because it was translated from a type manuscript, from a handwritten response in Machuba. Amar Rebbe Yitzchak, this is an Egel HaZahav that we're transitioning to. What is an Egel HaZahav? So we have Ebekam Melech Hadash. We have this idea of a betrayal type of evil, betrayer. Evildoer. We have a Amalek, indiscriminate joker type evil. Amar Rebbe Yitzchak, and now we have a golden calf. Amar Rebbe Yitzchak, Ein lecha kol paraniot, paraniot sheba lo olam she'ein ba'echad me'esrim ba'arba ba'hefra litra shel egel harisha. Punishment all stems, offers the Gemara in Sanhedrin, from the Egel HaZahav. Every type of evil, every type of downfall, every type of wrongdoing stems from the mistake of the Egel Hazav. The Egel Hazav was a mistake. If you read the text in its plainest form, the Bnei Yisrael, the Israelites in the wilderness, appealed to Aaron to construct a golden calf, not because they wanted to replace God, but they needed an intermediary to replace Moshe. And that's what they thought was the best representation of an intermediary. It was a terrible, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to defend it. It was a horrible mistake, but it's a mistake at its outset, which leads to so much more punishment and wrongdoing. And that is exactly what Rabbi Moshe Nachum Yeruslimsky writes in the end of the 19th century about machine matzah. It's not the first time that he offered this critique. I received your letter today, and this is from an important book of sources, mostly by my colleague Eli Letterhead. I received your letter today, and I'm responding in the matter of the new machinim that have been invented to roll the matzahs. In your query, whether it is permissible to bake Passover matzahs on these machines, even though the machina has been modified since my last response on the matter. So it's not the first time this posek has engaged the issue of machine matzah versus handmade matzah, when all the great rabbinical authorities raised their voices against it. So I was very much in the majority, he argues. Nevertheless, although the intention of those who modified the machine, this is critical, was to eliminate the problem, they were trying to overcome a challenge. In the process, they have violated other prohibitions and raised other doubts. And all of their so-called corrections merely undermine the very foundations of our law for our many sins. Therefore, it is incumbent upon all the leaders of the generation to step into the breach. I can only reiterate, says Yeruslaminsky. I can only reiterate what I wrote in my letter in Kremenchug, although my words contained no new point of law. I'm just telling you exactly what I had offered years ago. They were written with great sincerity and found their way to the hearts of those who faithfully keep the law of Israel. So much is at stake with matzah. It's a mitzvah d'oraita, of course. So that they all banded together and resolved to banish this golden calf, the device from Kremenchug. For it is a creation of the evil inclination and its infernal machinations. Now, I should say, machine matzah has developed significantly over time and corrected to ensure that it is an efficient tool to produce matzah under the time allotted to avoid making chametz. I should say that very clearly. Our machine matzah machines do not look like what I have on the screen over here. How does this rabbinic writer understand the problem? I get it, he says. You want a cheaper, you want in where there's great poverty in Europe at the end of the 19th century, when you do not have every opportunity to produce matzah. Remember, after all, this is 1897. In 1903, you would have major pogroms in Kishinev, for example, blood libels. And so it was no small thing to be able to produce matzahs discreetly, right? The supposition is that, what is the token blood libel accusation, is that Jews use the blood of Christian children, babies, to produce their matzahs, which we have no record of any Jew ever doing. But again, the accusation still loomed large. And so when it came to the production of matzahs, Jews took it very, very seriously, and they were discreet about the production of them. So machine matzahs were important from an economic point of view. It was also from a welfare, political welfare point of view. So it was no small thing. And nevertheless, the fear that that these machine matzahs would yield something closer to chametz, leavened bread as opposed to matzah, I get your point. You're not trying to violate the law. You're trying to get at something good, but trust me, it's an Egel Hazav. You don't understand what the outcomes of adopting this machinery is going to produce. And so, to be fair, we're going to play both sides of it. Both Zionists and anti-Zionists also looked to the Egel for to try to wrap their heads around around misgivings, around pernicious items, not evil. That's not what Egel Zahav is. But problematic situations in their own time. Lulei Chayta Egel were not for the sin of the Chayta Egel, writes Rav Kook, Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, Hayu HaUmod Yoshevet Yisrael, Meshlimin Am Yisrael, Modin Laham, so the inhabitants of Israel would have been reconciled with the people of Israel. I want to, though, skip to the middle of the section to make sure that we have time for everything. Ba'olam, where do I want to go? What is the sin of the golden calf? It is Vaharbi, here it is, in the 1, 2, 3, 4 lines from the bottom. Vigdisha ha-misoritsha al-pi ha-tarbut ha-chilonit. Rav Kook writes in 1920, after being exiled from Israel during World War I, in which he has been deeply exposed to the rest of Western Europe. He says, I have seen chilonit. I have seen a tarbut ha-chilonit. I have seen secularism. Shishilta harbei al ha-amim ha-ika al-yibam. And has made a mark, has made a deep impression on European culture and on the Jewish people who live there, Baharbe Midot Ra'ot, and is responsible for many evil things. This is Rav Kook. This is somebody who has, we know, for example, thought the Or HaGanus, that the light of creation was hidden in Rembrandt's art. This is somebody who appreciated certain non-Jewishly generated cultural and intellectual artifacts. Nevertheless, Chalima it does really hard. It does, it ravages the depths of the of the of people who have adopted secularism. It ravages their soul. And it produces illness. It is it's made bloody hadamim. It's produced cool. He blames secularism for World War I, for the Great War. And so, it's not even a refined, that's sophisticated. It's not well, literally, textured. There's no depth to it, way you would compare it to Judaism. That's what Rav Kook argues in Orot, right in the 1920s, that secularism is deeply problematic, but he understands the Netiyah. He understands what is so compelling about Western literature, about certain other elements. He doesn't define exactly what they are of secularism. And yet he suggests that beware, because that can lead to much worse. So again, Simmer, why does he deploy Egel HaZahav? Because he understands what's compelling about it. Nevertheless, the suggestion is to withstand it. I'm going to quote Rav Kook, Shavas Amarav. Bavarotenu harabim, because of our many sins, not in the Yom Moshe, but in a lesser known tract written in 1967 in response to the Six-Day War. Okay, not my own opinions. Bavarotenu harabim gam achshav. Jews are now undergoing a terrible evil, to'eva, an abomination. There are those in the wake of the Six-Day War who suggest that this was a miracle at the hand of God, that there's no explanation for Israel's success during the Six-Day War. It must be God's hand, comparable to the miracles in the departure from Egypt. Tried specifically to find sources which resonated with our Pesach theme. The Einam Simon Alev Kiad Barim Sovim Laromeim Koach Atuma Shel Tzionim Gruim V'Alfim Dargod Me'Egel Hazav. It's a thousand times worse than the gold cap. These Zionists who have that any adoption of such a position to understand the 6 day wars as miracles is to adopt a Zionist motif, a presentation, an analysis of the 6 day war. And it is, he understands what's compelling about it. But nevertheless, this is the handiwork of the Zionists. Of course, Satmar Rav being no proponent of Zionism. That's what he's suggesting in the wake of the 6 day war. Because there's no heresy that matches up. It's Zionism is peerless and it's heresy. I don't need to explain it anymore. You already know my position, says the Satmar Rav. Hatuma Muka Shaltioni goes on and on and on. And talks about how they want to say Hallel on in commemoration, which many congregations, just like personally I do, maybe even with a bracha, he suggests. No such thing. Beware the temptation of this Egel Hazal. Again, my issue isn't in the substance and the content per se, it's the understanding and a shared link in a reception of these templates throughout rabbinic writing. One in which there isn't much, it's not a very mature archetype. There isn't such a reception of it, but good for people to be aware of it, is in the pages, actually a footnote, in Rabbi Moshe Weissman's The Medrash Says, in his Vayikra commentary, towards the end in the discussion of the Molech cult, where in worshiping this cult, you march a child over fire. Even though, so what? How on earth? How could that resonate? What exactly is the analogy of the Molech cult in contemporary society circa 1982? Even though the Molech cult, this is in the Medrash says, in the actual sense of the word, is non-existent today, the application of the mitzvah has bearing upon us too. So even though, thank goodness, these things don't exist any longer, nevertheless, there's what to glean from it. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld and other Gedolim described a parent who entrusted his child to secular school. Here it's not Egel Hazav, but it's Molech. Whether to a non-Jewish school or a Jewish school founded upon non-Torah principles, as one who delivered his child to the Molech. Just as a parent is responsible for the physical care of his offspring, so must he be aware that the development of his child's soul depends largely upon his initiative. So what is Molech in this interpretation? It is sacrificing your child to an experience, to an atmosphere, which is so inhospitable, which is so unhealthy. In the case of an adolescent being sent to college, a parent will formulate ever so many justifications and rationalizations. Yet there is no question that the parent is unable to calculate and foresee the damage which will be inflicted upon the child's soul once he is exposed to the immoral environment of the university and the decadent philosophies of cleverly espoused by sophisticated professors. As soon as he has passed into the domain of the Molech priests, they are granted power over his mind. It is a Jew's task to educate his offspring in an environment of Kedusha and develop all the capabilities in the service of Hashem. Again, my issue is not to convince people to go or not to go to college. My business here is to understand that here the editor, of the writer, the author of the Medrash says, well, there's an impulse to frame his antagonism in terms of a biblical type. And it happens over and over and over again. Two more slides. These are two really, really interesting ones. Okay, good on time. Here is the Toldot Yaakov Yosef, which is in the main some of our primary sources of the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov. That's who's on the left. So from this biblical commentary, we understand many of the earliest teachings of the Baal Shem Tov. Otherwise, we don't have much. We have sources from generations much later. This Sefer, the Toldot Yaakov Yosef, is one of the earliest texts which have within it the ideas of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the we call proto Hasidic movement. By the light of wisdom, a soul is able to cleave to the creator, the Kone, but only after the straightest path is selected. Misulam. Ha Omer Ach Kasher Chanu Harifidim Sherifu Yadayim Midvar Torah Az Yavoa Malik Shu Hayitzar Hara. So going back to the Amalek, which is really important. That is why when the Israelites came to Nefidim and loosened their connection to Torah, Amalek arrived, namely that they were overwhelmed with the evil inclination. In Hasidic thought, what is Amalek? Amalek's not a person. It's very similar to what we saw from Rabbi Soloveitchik. The Hasidic, the dominant Hasidic thread when it comes to Amalek is that there is Amalek in each of us. There's a Yetzer Hara. There's an evil inclination in each of us, which is very different. And I'm so suggesting this slide and the next slide as a different way to symbolize, or I'd say symbolize, but to extract wisdom from these biblical evildoer archetypes. One is that there's a Malek in each of us. We all have room to improve. There's a part of us that is terribly illogical, and it's only when we loosen our bonds with our faith that we allow a Malek to come inside. I guess the superhero analogy, it's like Venom in the Spider-Man movie. But that's a Malek in Hasidic thought. It's a dominant strand throughout. Last source is a phenomenal one. This is a story that is, I believe, its earliest source is in Dov Katz's Tanuat HaMusar. We have primary sources which indicate that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter had a position of it, meaning that there's good reason to believe that a conversation was had between Rabbi Simcha Zissel and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter that mirrored this reproduction of it. Yutal Big Germania, Timach HaShita Ta'Orthodoxim, Sham the Mezigatorin Derecheretz. In Germany, many Jews were fond of the position of, oh, you can see the cursor. I'm so, oh, sorry. Many were taken by the rabbi of Frankfurt, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, and his Torin Derech Eretz philosophy. So much so that Rav Simcha Zissel, the student of the head, the founder of the so-called Musar movement, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, felt compelled to open Liftoach b'Kelm u'b'Groben, in both in Kelm and in Groben, a yeshiva l'narim, a boys' school, im tochnit rachba, with a wide curriculum, also on with languages, via diot kaliot, and certain Western themes, general studies, tachat, pikuach memshla, under the auspices of the local government. Kilim shoch at bnei ha'ashirim, why? In order to compel many of the wealthy folks in that area. The only way to get funding for a Torah education was to make it compelling for Jews to have both Torah and Derech Eretz. Ulam, however, Rabbi Yisrael Ra'ab Sheb Rusia, Doresh Sa'ad Zah Darka Zahira, Chokhmat Krucha Bosa Kanarab. Rabbi Simcha Zissel knew that to introduce secular, general, or non-Jewish studies, it potentially introduced a sakana rabba. It was deleterious. It could have been really horrible, pedagogically, educationally, socially, for these youngsters. That's not how he was trained, was Rav Simcha Zissel. Muvan ruchani, and he understood that spiritually, Baraki should rucha karebi Simcha Zissel, and they knew that only very gifted individuals like a Rav Simcha Zissel could withstand the temptation of certain secular ideas. Somebody like Simcha realized he was an elite, he was an exceptional personality. Only the elites could withstand the temptation of general studies. Only such a person could benefit from a mixed curriculum. So, what did Simcha Zissel do? Pam Sha'al et it's Simcha Zissel. At one point, Simcha Zissel asked, this is Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, one time Yisrael Salanter asked Simcha Zissel about his program in Groben specifically. Are you aware, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter asks the student, Simcha Zissel, that from your educational program could come, let's say it means a ha'egel, that an egel hazav, a golden calf, can be the deliverable, the outcome of your system. After he said, yeah, I realize what's at stake. That's only after Simcha Zissel admitted that, you know what, we'll take certain precautions, but there is a danger. There's a looming danger in opening up a school that introduces non-traditional elements into Jewish education. And only then did Rabbi Yisrael Salanter give him the okay. Obviously, Simcha Zissel was looking for the okay. Kilomar acharei shehu makir at the sakana shel hadavar, after Simcha Zissel demonstrated openly to his teacher, to his mentor, that he understood the inherent dangers, yeshliv toach. Only then did Rabbi Yisrael Salanter have faith, in him. Then he knew that he would not falter anymore. Once you recognize the potential of an egel hazav, once you've demonstrated in a SWOT analysis, in a risk assessment, there were inherent dangers in them, only then do you move forward and you make that decision. It's really interesting. So those last two sources, I think, are different than everything else we've seen. On the whole, in the main, rabbinic writers have been looking externally, at least to their community, even in the case of the Bundists. They consider them to be ancillary to their inherently Jewish community. They sort of cast them out as outsiders. But in most cases, when rabbinic writers, sermonizers, are looking to understand evil, their go-to is to identify the biblical villains that make the most sense. We make sense of our lives. Same thing with our heroes, I'll repeat again, is that we are comforted to understand our heroines in the context of a Sarah, or a Esther, or a Devorah, or a Bruria, or a Miriam. We want to do that because it's a framing. It makes us comfortable. We understand the boundary lines. It's context. It says a lot. You don't need to say much more. If so-and-so is a modern-day Esther, so obviously she and this who is this heroine? Somebody who invoked politics. Somebody who maybe was able to work hard and to negotiate a settlement with the monarchy. Maybe he was married to an Ahasuerus, was able to pull the political levers. That's an Esther. You don't need the verbiage anymore. Somebody's a modern-day Esther. If somebody's a modern-day Yehuda HaMaccabee, a Judah the Maccabee, he's burly. He's got lots of muscles. He's got a certain intuition for military expertise. And the same thing for evildoers. What you see in the last two sources is a new possibility, one that hasn't been taken up more times than the other version, which is, what if evil isn't an archetype? What if evil is part of our assessment framework? Every choice that we make has good contingencies and less good contingencies. What if a malek is simply a possibility that we assess and we make our decisions trying to avoid it. What if an egel hazav? There's an egel hazav in every planning phase that we embark upon. Maybe there's an egel hazav in everything that we cultivate, that we generate, and we nourish. And by recognizing that, we understand a direction that we need to take. Maybe there's always a ve'akam melech hadash. Maybe betrayal is always a possibility of not just the human condition, but the contingencies, right? The possibilities of the course that we adopt, of the road that we take, and the road that we don't take. And so what if evil, if we don't rush necessarily to identify the evil, we understand that evil and good are both possibilities. And they're all, not every instance are they easily able to be distinguished. But those last two sources, the Hasidic approach and the Musar approach, anybody who know me, that's not exactly how I live my life. But it resonates with me. That it suggests that rather than trying to understand evil, let's preempt evil. And maybe that's a different way of understanding the biblical archetypes. They're always present. It's just a matter of what we do about it. Okay. So we have a few minutes. I want to make sure that we had some time for questions. I see that the chat had a number. I tried to, with some finesse, anticipate and look over my shoulder, so to speak, with some of the questions. Right, it's a lot of stories about Pesach. Very similar to our food, right? Food always has a way of being a part of our heritage and of our inherited memories of our family. Yeah, it's a really good. I encourage everybody to look at the case over here in the chat. Right, what have you done for me lately? So they're all part of our condition. And maybe that's the best way to make the Torah and all of its strange incarnations, how to make them live longer. Again, two different approaches, very, very different. What we've seen for certain, I hope, in our immediate investigation, and I promise you I didn't cherry pick, is that very discreetly, the rabbinic mind has interpreted very specific forms of evil. There is a specific Yosef, a biblical pharaoh who forgot Joseph. There is a type of evildoer that is unabashed Amalek. There's an Egel Hazav, a horrible mistake gone terribly awry, right? There's a Molech cult. I don't know if it's college. All of these are very specific types of evil. But on the other hand, there's the opportunity to identify, to use these types to understand our own personal calculations, our own political calculations, our calculus, and the contingencies of how we live our lives. Okay. If there are any questions, I guess I'll see you next week.
We're on to the I have a different question.
Please.
When you're using the motifs of Amalek and Egel Hazahav, which are biblical motifs, aren't you hardening the positions because you're casting it in a biblical, i.e. direct from God kind of motif, which allows less opportunity for conciliation, for debate, for discussion, for persuasion? And you're just saying, they're evil, they're Amalek, they deserve Mita, and all the rest of it.
I'll give you a great example of that. In December 1862, Ulysses X. Grant expelled Jews from his military encampment. Now, not many Jews were expelled because the strategy of the Confederate Army was to destroy the cable line, so it didn't really get wide. General Orders Number 11 was what it was called. But it became a very live debate when Grant ran for president in 1868. And those who were hardened, another biblical image, thank you very much for that, who said, we can't vote for this Jew hater, one that his wife, Grant's wife, called the most obnoxious order. This is for those who are uninitiated, President Lincoln, he immediately renounced the order altogether, which speaks a lot to the Jewish engagement with Lincoln and his memory. But in 1868, those who opposed him called him a Haman. You're a Haman. And that gave little wiggle room. They were hardened by it. You fit into this type and I am incorrigible. I do not want to look at Grant in any other way. It doesn't matter what the rest of his legacy is. It didn't matter. Appomattox didn't matter one bit. I'm not going to vote for you. And another who wouldn't have used the Haman image, the Haman image, was a lot more malleable. And I think you're right. Once we cast evil or any condition in a particular framework, biblical or otherwise, we tend not to negotiate change in that way. I think you're right. I think that whenever you have a category, whenever you fit anybody into a mold, you're going to be resistant to see a different side. That's a good point. But I think that the rabbinic mind in the sermon is designed to create archetypes. Very rarely does a rabbinic sermon look to nuance. The sermon is not the most effective way to convey nuance in many instances. You only have. Now people are clamoring for an under 7 minute sermon, even more so. We don't have so much time. I would say by and large that the sermon was leveraged by orators to say very specific things and to make certain generalizations, good or bad. It's a good point. Okay. All right. We will trace the reception of the four sons in various curious, sinuous meanderings next week. So I'll see you all then. Wonderful to learn with you.
Tudarabha.
Bye-bye, Kasha. Bye-bye.